The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The New Humanism and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Ibsen, psychologist and critic of modern society. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, Ibsen is the giant of modern drama, the greatest dramatic genius since Shakespeare. The surprising fact is that his criticism of society applies more pungently to our America than to the Scandinavian world for which he was writing. If we consider his originality and depth of thought, his development of a new form of dramatic art, and his profound influence on contemporaries and followers, he is the outstanding figure in world literature since Goethe. Such a master transcends our classifications. We think of him as a great realist, holding the mirror up faithfully to life. With that, he is also an idealist, a dreamer of dreams, with a symbolism as far-reaching as Maeterlinck's own. At times, he seems to us a cynical Mephistopheles, coldly using the anatomist's knife on the evils of society. At other times, he is a flaming Jeremiah, arraigning the world. We miss in him the geniality that marked Shakespeare and Goethe. He is an ice Jotun of the Northland, but ever ready to flame into the Loki of destructive fire. Born in 1828, the same year with Tolstoy, Ibsen was of Danish, German, and Scotch ancestry. His boyhood was somber, for the affluent father lost all his property except one poor farm when Ibsen was a lad of eight. There were years of sordid poverty, and then at 15, Ibsen was sent down to Greenstadt, a small town on the southeast coast of Norway, to clerk in a drug shop. For 6 years, he did distasteful work by day and ate his heart out in brooding loneliness at night. The revolution of 1848 caught his imagination, and with the partly finished play Catiline in his pocket, he removed to Norway's capital, Christiania. He starved on hack work for a time, until the attention of Ole Bull, the Norwegian violinist, was drawn to him. Through Ole Bull's influence, Ibsen was appointed director of the newly established National Theater at Bergen. The salary was small, and he had to do everything: arrange stage, scenery, costumes, coach the actors, direct the play, occasionally write it. At 29, he married, happily, and was transferred to the somewhat larger theater at Christiania. Here he had 6 more years of doing everything concerning the staging of the plays. Probably no other dramatist, not excepting Shakespeare, ever had such drastic training in stagecraft, which on the basis of his dramatic gift made him the master he became. The plays he wrote during this period dealt chiefly with Norway's heroic past. He was given a small sum to go north and collect Norwegian folklore, material used later in Peer Gynt. And at 35 was granted a small poet's pension from the crown. The following year he left Norway at the crisis of the war between Denmark and Prussia with other German states over Schleswig-Holstein. Ibsen regarded that war as an international crime perpetrated by Germany and wrote a stirring lyric, A Brother in Need, urging Norway to rise and help. The government responded but would act only with France and England, who refrained from action then, as recently they have again, under still more flagrant circumstances. In disgust, Ibsen sailed over the seas to Italy. There, under the sunny skies, with the wealth of classic association to stimulate his imagination, he produced the long dramatic poem Brand, a scathing arraignment of his countrymen for their timid vices and virtues, but with a profound philosophy running through it. It teaches that life is worth not what you are, but that to which you dedicate yourself. Gradually, the higher truth emerges that love must guide will to deal wisely with human beings, imperfect as all are. Having freed himself from this mood, he turned to Norwegian folklore and at 39 produced the unique Peer Gynt, supreme example of Ibsen the poet, creating beauty and significance for the imagination. Like Brand, it contains deep philosophy of life. Peer, believing he was realizing himself by gratifying every whim, fulfilled only the troll maxim, to thyself be enough. Solveig is the one who goes straight through, becoming the woman God meant her to be, while the true Peer Gynt existed only in her transfiguring love. The Italian war drove Ibsen to Germany, his home for much of the next 20 years. He was still poor and struggling in spite of the success of his long poems, but refused offers of translation work to dedicate himself to his art. Meantime, he was reacting on blatant superficial democracy, seeing the true revolution in the spirit of man. At 41, he published The League of Youth, satirizing the local situation in Norwegian politics and breaking for a time with Bjørnson. The result was a fury of attack, the papers containing it reaching Ibsen at Port Said, where he was guest of the Khedive at the opening of the Suez Canal. He answered with a bitterly satiric poem. Later, for the Millinery Festival, he sent home a poem which best of all shows his fighting heroism in proclaiming advanced and unpopular convictions. Let me quote it. "My countrymen who filled for me deep bowls of wholesome bitter medicine, such as gave the poet on the margin of his grave fresh force to fight where broken twilight rolls, my countrymen who sped me o'er the wave, an exile with my griefs for pilgrim souls, my fears for burdens, doubts for staff to roam, from the wide world I send you greeting home. I send you thanks for gifts that help and harden, thanks for each hour of purifying pain. Each plant that springs in my poetic garden is rooted where your harshness poured its rain. Each shoot in it, which blooms and burgeons forth, it owes to that gray weather from the north. The sun relaxes, but the fog secures. My country thanks. My life's best gifts were yours." After several years of intense labor, Ibsen finished at 45 his longest work, Emperor and Galilean, which did not prove, as he hoped, to be his masterpiece. The canvas was too broad, and the theme did not give scope for his philosophy. Returning to Italy, he produced at 51 A Doll's House, the first play in which he completely found himself and initiating the great series of dramas by which he is now known internationally. It is significant of his long and slow development that the series came so late. While a most effective stage play, A Doll's House proved to be an important social document, greatly accelerating the movement for emancipating women. It was a theme of discussion at every tea party and café clutch throughout Europe. The result was to make Ibsen wonder if he might have a function as teacher. He had not thought of himself in that capacity. In an early letter to the King of Norway, he had said, "My aim is to make my people think great thoughts." With a new idea, he produced Ghosts, carrying out the study of heredity begun in A Doll's House. The response was a storm of attack due to his having arraigned social as well as biological ghosts. He was as much surprised as he had been by the contrasting reception of A Doll's House. He did not wait the usual 2 years before replying. His regular habit in the great series was to spend a year thinking out his characters from birth to the end of their lives, and then use the second year to write the brief chapter given in his play. This time he came back at his critics in a year with An Enemy of the People. While a good stage play, it is less carefully finished than the others in the series and is rather a social satire containing the most drastic indictment of democracy that has been made since Plato. Through Dr. Stockmann, he argued that the rule of the majority must mean the rule of the many fools over the few wise, and that the new and therefore most important truths will always be in possession of a small minority on the advancing margin of life. Ibsen never saw the answer to his indictment, which we can see, and so reached the nadir of pessimism in The Wild Duck, produced at 56. It portrays the meddling reformer going about presenting the claim of the ideal and succeeding only in disrupting the adjustments poor broken-winged humans have made of their lives. He had been away from Norway for 20 years, with only a brief visit home. At 57, he returned for a longer visit. The long struggle with poverty was over. He had been a careful saver and shrewd investor, and was now affluent and famous. He spent the summer at Molde on the coast, brooding over the sea. The situation in Norway deeply distressed him because of the bitter passions aroused by the 10 years' fight, finally completely successful, for a constitutional democracy. In a speech to working men, he said, "Nobility of character must be introduced by women and labor, for it is character alone that makes us free." He returned to Munich and produced Rosmersholm. While inspired by Norway's political situation, it became a story of human beings and human fates. It is the supreme example of the retrospective drama, beginning just before the tragic crisis, then withdrawing veil after veil from the past causing it. This was Ibsen's characteristic method in the late group of plays. The summer at Molde and another at the north end of Jutland had reawakened Ibsen's love and longing for the sea. In that mood, he wrote The Lady from the Sea, the one play in which he dreams life out to serene and happy conclusion, giving his philosophy of marriage as the voluntary acceptance of mutual responsibility by two intelligent persons on a plane of moral equality. Next came the remorseless Hede Gabler, depicting, as he said, human beings, human emotions, and human destinies upon a groundwork of certain of the social conditions and principles of the present day. The crown of Ibsen's stage dramas in technical execution, it is pure psychology of character with no political or other extraneous element. At 63, Ibsen went home to Norway for the remainder of his life. The Masterbuilder, produced soon after, is his personal dream, inspired by a moving brief chapter of his own experience, which shocked him into wondering if he had climbed as high as he had built. Radical in thought, he had been singularly conservative in life, and must have asked, had he an absorbed portrayal of life, forfeited life? Now settled in Christiania, renowned and prosperous, he continued to brood over life, creating men and women in its tangled skein. The poignant little Eyolf is a culmination of symbolism. All the characters, except the lovely and by the critics misunderstood Rita, being symbols. John Gabriel Borkman followed, portraying a financial schemer, but centering on the heart of Ibsen's philosophy that the unpardonable sin is the sin against love. This receives clearest expression in Ibsen's last play, which he called his epilogue, When We Dead Awaken. What an epilogue it is to what a life. It shows that if art, instead of being made a way of life, is substituted for life, when we dead awaken, we discover that we have never lived, and the art turns to dust and ashes in the artist's hand. While he was working on this play, Ibsen's 70th birthday had been celebrated with many honors. The excitement brought a slight stroke, but he rallied to complete When We Dead Awaken. A severe stroke followed. He lingered through 6 years with periods of partial darkness, tenderly cared for by his devoted wife, and died at 78. Life is not as remorseless as Ibsen. He takes one tendency of character and carries it to extreme conclusion, where in life there are compensating adjustments and a power of recovery he did not recognize. In the complex world of men and women, good and evil, light and shadow, laughter and tears are mingled together in the stream of life. It was not for Ibsen to show this, but what a master he was, with profound psychology and deep grip on life, creator of men and especially of women, Agnes, Solveig, Nora, Elida, Hilda, Rita, Irene, do they not live, becoming of those immortals to whom we turn for solace of spirit? Great, grim Jotun of the Northland, born into the fever-stricken modern world, yearning for the companionship of the ice peaks, but doomed to the solitude of the cities, Ibsen, with all his pessimism, is wholly constructive in philosophy. He teaches that self-realization is neither in indulgence nor in renunciation, but in heroic action, accepting all the bonds of the spirit, that life, to be worthwhile, must be based on truth, lived in freedom, and crowned by love.
Ibsen, psychologist and critic of modern society, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author.